We have come to that time in our academic year when the pressure begins to mount. As I speak to different students over these last several days, I have noticed a growing sense of intensity, concern. Met the other evening, Cynthia and I did, with a number of our graduates, or those who are graduating, or hoped to be graduating, and sensed from them, not only from their faces, but even from some of their questions, that sense of uneasiness, the growing uncertainty, and all of that goes with the end of March and the arrival of April and the end of the academic year. It occurred to me that there were some things that all of us could benefit from out of the 40th chapter of Isaiah. And I would invite you to turn quickly to this section, and in the time we have, I would like to simply distill some thoughts that I feel will address these growing questions, where some might begin to feel what is going on is not only unfair, but is even unjust of God. Why me? Why is this happening now? Why is this occurring, of all things? The Lord doesn't even seem to care, because it has been going on, and now it seems to be reaching that out-of-control situation. Hard times push us to the wall. Now, the prophet never tells us what the test was that brought the people to the wall, but the Lord gives him a marvelous word in the beginning of the chapter and follows through on the theme of it all the way to the end of this grand literary piece of the 40th of Isaiah. Those of us who love music are reminded of Handel's masterwork, as it all begins with the tenor aria and the recitative out of Isaiah 40. Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare has ended, that her iniquity has been removed. Words of comfort and relief are encouraged to fall from the lips of the prophet Isaiah. Tell the people that they have every reason to be comforted. There are messianic overtones, no doubt, but let me stay with the historical, not only then but now. Whatever it was in the lives of the people of God, the tests called for a reminder that they could know and they could experience comfort from their God. Isaiah was like this third verse, a voice calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Remember the words from Handel's work? Let every valley be lifted up and every mountain and hill made low. And let the rough ground become plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley, reads the New American Standard Bible. It goes on. And you get down to verse 9. Isaiah's desire is to turn the people's attention back on the Lord. Get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Behold, the Lord God will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him, his recompense before him. And then the great alto solo, taken from this next verse. Like a shepherd, he will tend his flock. In his arms, he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. The emphasis now falls on God's control. Time doesn't allow me to go through that. Verses 12 through 20. God's care of the earth, God's oversight of His creation. And that all leads to a series of questions, beginning at verse 21, as the prophet is led by the Spirit of God to a climax at the end of the chapter. 21, the question, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? You ask by now, what is it? What is it we're to know? What is it we're to understand? What is it that has been declared from the beginning that is to bring me this sense of comfort? The answer falls between 22 and 26, and it addresses the whole person of and work of the living God. He it is who sits above the vault of the earth. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. Scripture at times seems to favor some of these insects. I was reminded of the words of the prophets who went into the land to spy it out. And when they came back, they said, we're like grasshoppers compared to those who are the giants in the land of Canaan. I'm reminded of Daniel 4:35. All the inhabitants of the earth are as nothing. And He does according to His will in the army of heaven or among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can ward off His hand or say unto Him, what are you doing? Again, the picture in contrast of the greatness of our God and the smallness of each one of us compared to Him and His greatness. Verse 23, He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted. Scarcely have they been sown. Scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth. And the storm carries them away like stubble. And then he asks, to whom will you liken me? That I should be his equal. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. The one who leads forth their host by number, he calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. In the vastness of just this universe, one among many galaxies, and all of those stars that fill the skies on the clear nights, he calls them all by name. He put them all into place as one half of a verse in the creative week of Genesis 1. And he made the stars also. I often chuckle when I've read that. Oh, before I forget, he made the stars also. Now he who created these things, who made these things, who called them all by name, the whole point of it is that he, though vast and mighty and magnificent and resplendent in glory, cares about you and about me. That's why there's comfort for the people of God. Verse 27, there are two common responses from those who haven't looked at the stars lately and reminded themselves of God's vast might as well as His personal care. The first response is, my way is hidden from the Lord. How could He care about me at the campus of Dallas Seminary? How could He care about me, a first or second year student, or a fourth or eighth year student at the seminary? Who am I of all the things God has to concern Himself with? Who am I as a faculty member in my second or third year at the school? Who am I among all of the things of God's concern? My way is hidden. He asks in verse 27, why do you say that? Why do you say that, O student? O teacher here, O Jacob? Why do you assert that, O nation? My way is hidden from the Lord. Another response is, I'm not getting what I have coming to me. My rights, which, by the way, these days seem to be more important than anything to many people. He puts it in other words, the justice due me escapes the notice of my God. I've got this coming. I mean, after all, I've given up all of these things to serve him. And now, look, the bottom is sort of dropped out and debt is increasing. And bills are hard to make, and studies come hard, and work is long, and the body is getting weary, and my mind is tired. And there's a test the next hour. It just goes on and on. And if that isn't enough, I'm facing the whole raft of exams in the immediate future. It just doesn't seem like it ever lets up. Now, he answers that by reminding us of our God. First, who he is. Second, what he does. And third, why he does it. And he begins again with questions. Do you not know? Haven't you heard? Now, here, we smile at that because we hear all the time. That's what our classes are about. There probably hasn't been a class you've attended that the name of God has not been mentioned. Numerous times. God in the sweep of history. God in the subjects of theology. God in the giving of the languages. God in the directing of his people. God in the survey of the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation. Have you not heard? We hear all the time. Do you not know? Isn't it possible? Probable that when the Bible becomes our textbook, we become dull of hearing? Or that some bit of technical knowledge makes us arrogant and does a number on our need for a devotional walk with Him? Can't that happen? It can with me and does. It can with me and did as a student. And so I need to ask myself, don't I know? Have I not heard? And then he names him for us, the everlasting God, if that isn't enough, the Lord, and if that doesn't intensify it sufficiently, the Creator of the ends of the earth. It's as though there's a crescendo mark there. The one you're referring to that has overlooked you, that has forgotten your rights. Well, you're talking about the one who is eternal. You're talking about Yahweh, Jehovah himself, the one who has named the stars, the creator of the ends of the earth. The point is, the one who has his heart even in the remotest extremity. Where Jesus said, you are to take my message to the remotest part of the earth. It is the God who cares even about that. And you may feel you're there right now. You're talking about one whose heart is on even the remotest part of the earth. And please observe his attributes. He doesn't become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and put your name there. To the one who lacks might, he increases power. You're talking about one who has never once said in his existence, I am bush. I am spent. I'm so tired of hearing that same bunch of students coming to me with their prayers and concerns. I'm gone for the day. I'm out of here. Never once. Never once. That cannot happen with our God. He is unable to respond like that because of who he is. And back in Psalm 139, it just occurs to me, this is a good place to glance at a wonderful thought, which is along these same lines. Not simply about who God is, but along with who He is, how He cares for me. Look at the psalm as it unfolds. Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down, when I rise up. Isn't that great? You understand my thought from afar, meaning before I have the thought, You understand it. You've already analyzed it, seen through it, know the motive, all of it. You know it all. I love the NASB rendering. Thou dost scrutinize my path and my lying down and art intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, Thou dost know it all. This is clearly an unfolding of the omniscience of our God. You know it all. He learns nothing. We inform Him of nothing. He never once goes, oh, I didn't realize that. Glad you told me. He understands it all. The psalmist says, it's too wonderful. I can't take it in. Verse 6. And so he turns to His omnipresence. Where can I go from Your Spirit? Where can I flee from Your presence? He goes to the heights and He goes to the depths. If I ascend to heaven, Thou. That's the way the Hebrew reads. Just the pronoun. You. If I go to the heavens, it is You. If I drop to the lowest part of the earth, You. If I take the wings of the dawn, I would suggest that has reference to the rays of the sun that flash from the horizon at dawn. If I could travel the speed of light and find myself, here it is again, in the remotest part of the sea, the tiniest little island, even there, Your hand will lead me and Your right hand will hold. That's a marvelous thought. This all-knowing and all-present God has me in the crosswires of His sights. I find marvelous comfort in that. Isaiah 40, verse 29, He, along with these things, gives strength to the weary. He gives might to the one who lacks it. And now, along with these other things that He does, please observe the comparison. Two specifics are given. He gives, though youths grow weary and tired, the word is most often used of the very, very young, the little lads, the little gals. Though they get weary and tired, that doesn't happen. A test was done at Purdue University I read about some time ago where one of the strapping athletes on the campus was given the assignment in his class to follow around a four-year-old and to do exactly what the four-year-old did all day. He was exhausted by 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And the four-year-old was just like the energizing battery, just goes on and on and on. But even youths grow weary and tired, and to add to it, vigorous young men can ultimately stumbled badly. Walt Kaiser, in one of his works, renders this draftees. And even draftees can stumble badly. To give the picture of young manhood, the picture of strength, those who for whom fitness is a lifestyle, the Olympic-type athletes that you look at and imagine yourself as one of them in your dreams as you see them there. Though the vigorous young man stumbled badly. Now, he's building from his message of comfort and the reminder of who God is. He's now bringing it all home. What does it all have to say? What is the secret of connecting with that kind of strength in the midst of my stress? Tomorrow I'll talk about the wrong kind of response to these stresses. Today, the right kind. The secret is in waiting. And the most unnatural thing for type A people, the most unnatural response for very intelligent folks who pretty well can get their own way or work their way out of whatever jam, is to wait. And yet that's the answer. Yet those who wait for the Lord. I'm intrigued by the word kawa. It is used for a strand, a thread. And at times has reference to stretching or twisting. And it's the picture of twisting and stretching a small thread or strand around that which is stronger, or continually stretching with other threads and other points of strength, like a rope. And the tiniest thread is as strong as the complete rope. And it's the whole idea of my wrapping my inabilities and inadequacies around him who has never known either. And as I wait in that stretching, wrapping time of trust, there is an exchange. I get his strength in place of my weakness. I get his adequacy in place of my inadequacy. That's what he's getting at. Those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. I'd even suggest exchange weakness for his strength. We exchange as he gives what's needed to handle what we're facing. Back almost 55 years ago, a very lovely song was written by Annie Johnson Flint that has thrilled us numerous times. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy to multiplied trials. His multiplied peace. The connection is in the waiting. That's the hard part for people like us. You learn many things in your seminary years. Sadly, you do not learn from anyone but your God how to wait. If we hope for that which we do not see, we, with patience, wait for it. And in the waiting, he doesn't mock us. He re-strengthens us. He undergirds us. And the promise is that we will fly free, free of the encumbrances of what I will talk about tomorrow, of worry and stress and anxiety. We will fly like fresh pinions on the wings of an eagle. We will walk and not get tired. Run and not get tired. Walk and not become weary. I've been encouraged in my search through the Scriptures recently to find how many waited on God. The first significant waiter seems was Noah, who built for 120 years that boat that prepared them for the flood. Abraham, his biography begins at age 75, it ends at age 175. He doesn't get his son until he's 100. The promised child, he has waited for years with his wife of 10 years his junior. So she at age 90, he at age 100, waited for Isaac, who was given exactly as God promised. Moses, 40 years in the desert at age 80, encounters a bush that doesn't stop burning. And having blown it before, he is now very reluctant to step back into the battle and argues with God about the calling. I did a study on Moses a number of years ago and came across three of the most prominent perils in the ministry. The first is intensity, running before we are sent. The next is insecurity, retreating after we have failed. And the third is inferiority, resisting when we are called. Moses experienced all of them. Joseph waited in prison, though forgotten, before promoted. David waited for years after being declared king and anointed as such, while Saul completed his course of treachery and attempted murder. Job waited a long season of pain for relief. Nehemiah waited 4 months for the door to open in the heart of the king to give him approval, and even waited for several days before telling the people about his plan to rebuild the wall. It goes on and on. Waiting is the rule, not the exception. Some of you have a period of waiting in front of you. You don't know about it right now, but it's going to happen. It can be the most disillusioning, or it can be for you a strengthening time. And waiting on God is to bring rest rather than a restlessness, knowing that we are experiencing the exchange while serving Him in whatever way He pleases, which may include some obscurity and absolute anonymity. Don't fight that. And worse, don't act like you're doing it well, but really you're faking it. That's the worst kind. I read some years ago about a group of young GIs who were stationed in Korea just before the Korean War broke, early 1950s. They hired a young Korean lad to work for them and to polish their shoes and do the cooking and kind of clean the house, and they paid him a meager salary. He was in turn learning English as best he could, and these guys were just full of the devil, and they would play every trick on him you could play. They'd nail his shoes to the floor, and he'd get up in the morning and had to pull the nails out. They'd put buckets of water above the door, and he'd open the door, and water would splash all over him. And he had this magnificent attitude. They just couldn't get his goat. They'd put Vaseline on the stove knobs, and he'd start to turn on and get stuff all over his hands. So finally, his good attitude just broke him. And in shame and guilt, they had a meeting one evening, and they said, "You know, we're sorry. We should never have done that. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to treat you right." He said, "No more nail shoes to floor. No more. No more water on the door. No more water. No more buckets of water. No more sticky on stove. No more." "Okay," he said. "No more spit in soup." And you know, I have found that when I play the part of waiting on God, I can be spitting in the soup while nobody is looking. And usually the only ones who know that are the members of my family, who see me with all the guard down. I would encourage you, as your walk with Christ is being cultivated along with your study of the things of God, that you leave room for waiting and you guard against spitting in the soup. We get so good at living double lives that we don't stop it when we leave here if we're not careful. Our hope is in the Lord. Our confidence does rest in Him, and He is the source of our strength and comfort. Father, thank You for a simple word from this grand book You have preserved for us. In this very quiet moment, speak, Lord, in the stillness as we wait on You. Hushed is our heart to listen in expectancy. And teach a young and old alike anew, Father, for we're all waiting on something. Teach us in the process of the silence and the stillness that you neither slumber nor sleep. You have never known your first moment of weariness or disillusionment. Your plan is being unfolded, and we are in the midst of it by your grace. Remind us of that when doubts would steal our thoughts and blight our faith like the morning frost. Help us, our Father, to walk in authenticity before you as your men and women in a world that has long since lost its way. We pray for Jesus' sake.